Hello, and welcome to another installment of Ajam Media Collective's Emerging Scholarship Series. I'm Rustin Zarkar, and today I'm here with Mikya Kuyagi, an assistant professor at New York University's Department of Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies. It's a pleasure to have you here. So your latest research project focuses on the Trans-Iranian Railroad and its role in promoting particular notions of public space and society in Iran. But before we get into the details of these social transformations, could you give us a brief introduction as to the history of the railway in Iran, particularly when was it built, how was it built?
Sure. The Trans-Iranian Railway was the first extensive railway that was built in Iran to connect the new port of Bandar Shah on the Caspian Sea with another new port called Bandar Shahpur on the Persian Gulf. So it was a railway to connect northern Iran with southern Iran via Tehran, the capital. And there are two unusual characteristics about the Trans-Iranian Railway project. One is its late timing. The railway was built between 1927 and 1938. And 1938 is it's pretty late for railway construction compared to places like India and Egypt, which had railroad systems in the 1850s. So it's almost 80 years after these places, right? And this belated arrival of railway technology impacted various aspects of how the railway and a broad segment of Iranian society interacted. And another unusual thing about the Trans-Iranian Railway is that, unlike many other railroads in Asia and Africa, the Trans-Iranian Railway was built by the centralizing Pahlavi state. It was partially funded by the hefty taxes on tea and sugar. So the Pahlavi state initially had a contract with a German-American consortium to build the railroad, and then it canceled the contract with the German-American consortium, and eventually they built the railroad under the supervision of a Danish consortium called Kampsachs, which had experience with railway projects in places like Turkey. So these are the two unusual features of the Trans-Iranian Railway that I'm working on.
That's fascinating. And especially this part where you talk about its relative lateness in comparison to neighboring regions such as India and Egypt and Iraq, for example. So I'm just curious, why was this the case? Why did we see railroads in the 19th century in Egypt? I mean, obviously, I think about the colonial experience is slightly different than in Iran, but what was the primary reasons, and also how did it affect the perceived utility of the power of the railroad?
Okay. Sure. So there are several factors that were involved. First of all, the Qajar state did not have enough wealth to construct its own railway. And in fact, there was not really an idea among a lot of Iranian railway advocates of the Qajar era that the railway should be built by the state. So they saw it more as a private enterprise, and but they were unable to collect enough sufficient capital to construct a railroad either. And the ultimate obstacle came from the fact that Iran was a buffer state between the Russian Empire in the north and the British Empire in the south and east. And oftentimes, Nasiruddin Shah, the ruler of Iran in the second half of the 19th century, was pressured to balance out these two powers, which meant granting similar concessions to citizens of both empires. So if you give a concession to a citizen of the British Empire, you have to give a similar one to a Russian citizen. And in the 1880s, the competition for railway construction was becoming pretty intensive between the Russian Empire and the British Empire. And ultimately, Russia decided that rather than having both Russian and British-built railways in Iran, it's better to have no railways at all. It was a way to protect what Russia considered as the Russian turf in northern Iran. And the essential fear was that the British might enter into, you know, northern Iranian market and jeopardize Russian commercial advantage in the area. So in 1889, the Russian government signed an agreement with Nasiruddin Shah to ban railway construction in Iran for 10 years, and this agreement was later extended for another 10 years. And by the time this expired, World War I broke out.
Huh.
So essentially, that's, you know, one of the major reason why Iran didn't have a railway before 1927.
Okay. So this fits directly into kind of the standard narratives we hear about the Great Game in relation to Iran vis-a-vis Russia and Britain. And so one of the things that I find your project very interesting is that you kind of are bringing an alternative perspective towards the history of Iran. Can you just give us a brief of the Iranian Iranian Railroad? Can you just give us a brief introduction to kind of the historiography of mm-hmm. transportation technologies in Iran and what your project brings to this?
Right. Thanks for the question. There are, so because it was built by the Iranian state, the centralizing Iranian state, a nationalist state that was emerging in the 1920s and 30s, there are, I think, three specific historiographical problems that come from it. One is the overemphasis on the state itself, right? So state centrism is generally a problem in modern Iranian historiography, but especially in this case, we know virtually nothing about how various social groups experienced the project. All we know is more state propaganda constructed in the 1920s to 1940s by the Pahlavi state. And the second problem is the issue of periodization. Because we focus so much on the actions of of Reza Shah, we tend to ignore what was happening before, during the Qajar period, which had a major impact on how Iranians imagined the railway project, and also what came after during the occupation period, because only 3 years after the completion of the Trans-Iranian Railway in 1938, Iran was occupied by the Allies. So this period in the 1940s was pretty crucial when we think about how the railway was used by various groups. And the final problem I see is the focus on the Iranian nation, because it was perceived by the Pahlavi state as a nation-building project. Sometimes we ignore the transnational aspects of the project that are pretty crucial in constructing the imagination of the railroad, and also when we think about other issues like labor and traveling, we really can't ignore these aspects that go beyond the national border of Iran.
Well, that's a great introduction to not only the economic incentives, but the political reasonings and the political potential for this project. And now that we got those two things out of the way, let's move on to the social elements. The railway itself created a whole bunch of new public spaces, and this really affected Iranian society at large. So can you just give us a quick description as to how the railroad itself affected the daily lives of Iranians?
If I may oversimplify a little bit, there are obviously places, groups that were negatively affected, and there are groups that benefited from the project. And if you think about groups that were impacted in negative ways, I think one of the groups I can think of is some of the landowners. There are a lot of petitions submitted to the Iranian parliament by landowners around Tehran who complained about how their land was confiscated by the Pahlavi state during the initial construction phase in the 1930s, and they are still complaining about the same confiscation in 1941, 1942. So obviously, they had to keep submitting these petitions to the Pahlavi state without any tangible results. And other landowners, because of the environmental impact of the railroad, you know, some of the forests they owned were burned, and contractors often didn't compensate for that. And that was another contentious issue between some of the rural landowners and the consortium and contractors. Then we also have some of the former rice cultivating farmers in Mazandaran, the province of Mazandaran in the Caspian Sea region. In order to prevent malaria, the spread of malaria during construction, rice cultivation was banned in the immediate vicinity of the railway route, which displaced a lot of farmers who were, you know, growing rice there. So they had no option but to join the construction laborers along the route. So there are, you know, various types of dislocation that was going on. But at the same time, there were new economic opportunities for various groups. You know, villagers start going to these new stations to sell their agricultural products, right? And you also see the establishment of new institutions like hotels and tea houses around new stations. And also among laborers, too, we have some of the lower laborers in southwestern Iran who used to work on road construction sites. But the German-American Railway Consortium, they decided to pay twice as much to these construction laborers. And of course, there is a massive exodus of laborers from road construction sites to railway construction sites. So there is a sense of new economic opportunities for these people too. And finally, there is a huge influx of foreign workers, which is often ignored in the nationalist historiography, because, you know, the Danish consortium of campsites, it supervised the construction, but it didn't really engage in construction itself. And there are various contractors, multinational contractors from countries like not just Denmark, but also Sweden, Hungary, Germany, Switzerland, Italy, Britain. So there are various engineers and managers from various European countries coming to Iran. And in addition, we also see more skilled workers who came from places like southern Italy, Greece, Czechoslovakia, and Turkey. So you see an influx of thousands of foreign managers, engineers, but also a lot of skilled workers who came to Iran during the 1930s and stayed even in the 1940s.
And so this actually brings up a question that I'm very interested in, and this is about questions of mobility and travel in relation to the railway. And so from your article, you mentioned that one of the biggest things and most obvious things that happens and reason why you want to build a railroad is the fact that it gets you places faster. So considering that it would take a normal trip to get to Basra or to get to Baghdad, it would take a month's journey, I assume. Now you said it would take a 50-hour train ride, which is a crazy difference, right? And so this is one of the things that I'm interested in, is how we can talk about mobilities in its relationship to people. So how can people access these mobilities? What kinds of people were actually using the railroad, and for what purpose? And in addition, when we do talk about mobilities, let's talk about immobilities, which people were restricted from this access or had unequal access to.
Thank you. So when we talk about who used the railway, I think it's important to keep in mind that Iran experienced the Allied occupation from 1941 to 1945. And the Allies, when they occupied Iran, they forced Reza Shah to abdicate. And then they controlled various transportation routes, including highways and the Trans-Iranian Railway, in order to prioritize the transport of war material from the Persian Gulf in the south to the Soviet Union. So you see a lot of Allied soldiers, British, Indian, and later American soldiers, starting to use the railway for their movement. And you even see a lot of Polish refugees that Leo Sternfeld talked about in his interview with you guys a while ago. Some of them were Jewish, and they ultimately used the Trans-Iranian Railway to go to Palestine. And in any case, the Allies were restricting the civilian use of the railway, so the number of available seats for civilian passengers, Iranian passengers, decreased during the occupation. And also, motorized vehicles became increasingly more unavailable during the occupation because repair parts for automobiles became unavailable. And for instance, if you think about tires, right? When Japan occupied Malaya and the Dutch East Indies, rubber became unavailable, and that created the unavailability of tires in Iran. So all these factors contributed to the perpetually congested Iranian railway space because people had to rely more on the railway than they would have preferred during peacetime, and the number of available seats in trains decreased as well. And in terms of who used the railway in this context, the overwhelming majority of passengers in the 1940s were Shi'i pilgrims to Qom, and more importantly to the Atabat in Iraq, the Shi'i holy cities in Iraq. So they traveled by train from Tehran to Ahvaz, and from Ahvaz to Basra they used taxi. And from Basra to Baghdad, again, they could use the train. So, you know, it's interesting how this national project of the Trans-Iranian Railway, once it opened, it facilitated transnational pilgrimage in the 1940s. And most of them used third-class or fourth-class cars, which were essentially roofed freight cars without access to water, light and ventilation and so forth. And there were also a small number of tourists, vacationers from the emerging salaried urban professional families. They typically traveled from Tehran to northern Iran, and sometimes even they, the wealthy ones, had to use third-class trains when tickets were unavailable in this situation. Then we also have local villagers who traveled by train to go to nearby villages or urban centers to sell their agricultural products. But again, the unavailability of tickets was very problematic for them. So, for instance, in Firuzku County in northern Iran, which had a population of about 30,000 people, the railway organization sold only 4 tickets during the occupation. And of course, that wasn't enough, which forced a lot of villagers to kind of sneak in to the trains and become freeloaders. So in the context of the occupation, really impacted the way Iranian travelers could or could not use the railway.
Wow. So during this period, we're even seeing pilgrimage, we're seeing travel for leisure, and we're seeing Iranians from different walks of life interacting with one another in this space for the first time. And this brings me to something that you mentioned in your article, which you argue that the railway space becomes a microcosm of the heterogeneous Iranian nation. And this is in contrast to what many middle-class Iranians were thinking or wanted it to become. So how exactly did middle-class Iranians envision this space and the social relations that occur in this space? And at the same time, how were these visions propagated?
So what I call the railway space includes places such as stations, platforms, and cars. And this railway space included various elements of Iranian society. So like I said, in the trains, we see foreign passengers, a small number of tourists, and hundreds and thousands of pilgrims, and there are also freeloaders and so forth. So there's a lot of different kinds of travelers, like you said. And then on the platforms, especially in rural stations, we see a lot of beggars. Particularly in provinces like Lorestan in southwestern Iran, which experienced a construction boom in the 1930s. Once the construction period is over, a lot of former construction laborers became beggars and started to hang out at the stations to wait for passengers to come and begged money and coins from food from the passengers. And this is very different from what many modern middle-class Iranians envisioned, especially before the opening of the railway in 1938. And the vision of the Iranian railway space they promoted was a more homogeneous space that was essentially Europeanized. It was a space envisioned for Europeanized Iranian citizens who used the railway in order to tour around their homeland. Many modern middle-class Iranians saw in the new paved streets or in Tehran tramways or at cafes and various new public spaces that were being created in the early Pahlavi period, Iranians in railway space were imagined as, you know, Europeans, Europeanized both in appearance and behavior. So instead of having religious garments, they had to wear Europeanized clothing. And instead of carrying items that reflected their domestic life, such as samovars, water pitchers, and jars, they had to carry a bag. And instead of eating around the sofre, which is a piece of cloth that you place on the floor during meals and make a mess around the floor, they had to sit on seats and behave in an orderly manner. So the Iranian railway space was really imagined as a space for national citizens with proper behavior and without any signs of religious and domestic life. And of course they knew this was an unattainable goal, right? But that made the need to spread their vision through a press campaign more urgent in the 1920s and 30s. So in this period, we start seeing a lot of articles in the Iranian press that essentially had the effect of constructing what I call the railway traveler prototype.
That's fascinating. So the Iranian middle class actually had a completely different idea as to what the space should be. But how exactly was this vision propagated?
Sure. So in short, there was a massive press campaign in the 1920s and 30s that promoted traveling among newspaper readers who were primarily modern middle-class Iranians. And so to give you a little of a background, the Iranian press at the time was heavily censored by the Pahlavi state. And some of the pro-Pahlavi journalists had the privilege of traveling with the Shah's retinue before the railway officially opened. And they recorded their travels and published the travelogues on newspapers in order to sort of encourage other modern middle-class Iranians to travel for the purpose of first getting to know their compatriots in various other parts of the country to get, you know, to cultivate national consciousness and even spread national consciousness, but also in order to kind of enlighten what they perceive as unruly masses to internalize the proper behavior that they what they perceived as proper behavior in the public spaces, especially in the railway space. So it's almost like, you know, the number of travelogues you see in various newspapers in the early Pahlavi period is sort of like kind of the rebirth of the tradition of travelogues, Safarname, that was flourishing in the 19th century.
Oh, okay. So the urban elite thought that they could reform the masses using the space through emulation, right? So the idea that you had travelers who would set good examples as to how to act in the space. And these examples were set by the journalists. So the journalists would write about this and in the Safarnamas. So can you give us actually some examples as to some of these travelers and maybe give us a little background as to what they experienced there and their own visions of the space and how it was different from what they saw.
So setting an example for the rest of the population and closely interacting with other Iranians from, you know, different ethnic backgrounds didn't really happen for most travelers. Most just looked at them disdainfully and maintained a distance. So with that general trend in mind, I think there are two examples that I want that kind of give more complexities. One traveler is sort of an embodiment of this prototype. His name was Mahmoud Danishvar. He was a former office worker from Tehran. And he left Tehran for Khuzestan in late 1945, immediately after the end of the occupation, with the specific purpose of touring around the country and getting to know his homeland better. And he started to record what he witnessed for, you know, his compatriots who could learn about their homeland collectively. And in the first railway journey he experienced in late 1945, in the railway space from Tehran to Khuzestan, what he witnessed was, as you can expect, it's very different from what the ideals he had. So he witnessed a womanizer who was trying to seduce good-looking women, and he also saw a freeloader and a railway employee being bribed, and thieves and a swarm of pilgrims in black clothes and beggars. And then when he got off the train, he interacted with a porter at the station who thought Danishvar was a northerner but not an Iranian, which was a moronic question for him because you are either Iranian or not Iranian. Northerner, southerner, didn't matter for him. So all these encounters convinced him of the necessity of his mission to spread this national identity. So for the next 2 years, traveling around Iran for 2 years, he toured around Iran, recorded various customs and cultures of different parts of Iran, planted the Iranian national flag at the apexes of various mountains in provinces, and talked to the local populations to tell them that they are Iranians and not like Desfulis or, you know, Shustaris. And then, so compared to this example, the next example is it tells us more about how Iranians were not just blindly accepting the idealized public behavior of European passengers, but they were actually there was a process of constructing a more vernacular behavioral code that was appropriate for Iranian passengers. And he was also traveling from Tehran to Ahvaz in southwestern Iran in late 1945, immediately after the occupation. And in the railway space, what he had was a very interesting, enjoyable conversations with other Iranian passengers, you know, chatting together and sharing food. But he found British passengers extremely unpleasant because they were either extremely aloof or just completely ignored other passengers. So in the context of the Allied occupation and the growing resentment against the British as occupiers, he witnessed the behavior of British passengers, which was certainly orderly, but it wasn't enough for him. For him, sort of more close interaction, sharing food and chatting, had to be part of the proper behavioral code that he was starting to develop as he encountered various Iranian and foreign passengers in the railway space. So in that sense, the prototype wasn't kind of reproduced after 1938. People started to interpret in their own ways.
Huh. And unfortunately, we're running out of time, so I'm just going to ask one more question. how long does this age of travel via railway last? And do we see it going on until, let's say, the White Revolution in the 60s?
So the age of the railway, I think it was created almost by accident, by the occupation, which created a context in which rail travel became a lot more important than they would be without the occupation, right? Because of the unavailability of motorized vehicles. So once the occupation was over, the railway organization faced a number of problems. One was that the decline of demand, because there is no more Allied soldiers to transport, there is no more war material to transport. So there is a decline in the absolute demand as well. And then you also start seeing the end of restrictions on motorized vehicles, right? With the defeat of the Japanese, or the things like tires, rubber became available again, and restrictions on the use of highways by civilians, these were lifted as well. So motorized vehicles again became more common. So by the late 1940s, we start seeing intercity bus services, which was directly competing with the railway. And in fact, it was even better than the railway, because you can, you know, go to much smaller provincial cities directly. So the railway organization had to downsize by the late 1940s, firing around 12,000 people out of its 36,000 employees. Wow. Let's say we're talking about a huge number in the as early as the late 1940s. So I would say the age of the railway probably ended relatively quickly, even though the railway network itself continued to expand to new cities. You know, it expanded to Tabriz and to Mashhad, and it keeps expanding today, you know, to places like Shiraz. So it does keep expanding, but in terms of the centrality of rail travel for average Iranian travelers, it definitely started to diminish as early as the 1950s.
Well, Mikia, unfortunately, we're out of time, but I want to thank you for sitting
so
with
much.
Us and telling us about your project, and I wish you the best.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.